For the week of March 3rd, 2019, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 439, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Birmingham, Alabama, but I'm headed back to New York, I'm Michael Giltz. But I want to know one thing. Am I still the co-host of Showbiz Sandbox?
Yes. What happened? Why?
I don't know. Everybody else seems to have been impacted by the AT&T Time Warner merger, or AT&T, whatever Warner Brothers was called. So, there's so many job changes, we can't keep track of it all. Richard Plepler of HBO, he's out after like 20 years or something, or, ages, 17 years. No, 20.
Well, no, he started in the early 90s, like 1991.
Yeah, 92 to 2019. So that's like 28 years, 27 years, a long time there. He's been there from Tales of the Crypt, right, to Games of Thrones and Veep. He's gone. The head of Turner is gone. And in contrast, Bob Greenblatt has joined Warner Media Entertainment at the top. Jeff Zucker, Kevin Tsuchihara, and other people have all gotten more power and more turf. So, the ramifications of that are just happening left and right. They seem to know what they're doing. They have a plan.
Well, ultimately what this is, you might recall on last week's episode, we talked about, as we were recording, how the ruling came in against the Justice Department. The Justice Department had, of course, sued Warner Brothers and AT&T trying to prevent the merger. They lost in their initial round, and then the appeal also lost. After that appeal, I think they basically said, okay, this is going to stick, so we can actually start doing some reorg here.
And the people who were doing it and are in charge had a plan. They were ready to go, ready to hit the ground running, as opposed to the Writers Guild, which is planning to have a major strike against agents. They feel there's a massive conflict of interest between agents packaging shows and representing the producing side on the one hand and the writers on the other. And they're saying, hey, this cannot stand. And they've been meeting with people left and right. Last week, they had a disastrous meeting with managers that seemed to just go horribly. Just a day or two ago, they met with lawyers, a bunch of Hollywood lawyers. That wasn't quite the massive disaster that the other one was, but nobody walked away impressed. They say things like the Writers Guild doesn't understand the industry, crazy stuff like that. And they're basically, the one message from the lawyers and the managers seems to be, guys, if you stop the studio from having to pay a fee to agents, that doesn't mean the money's going to the writers. That seems to be their big takeaway. Maybe you should just be asking for a piece of the pie. But I say, it is a conflict of interest and it should end. Whatever the ramifications are, having your own agent also be your boss or represent the other side is not to your advantage. And there's too many examples of double dealing and bad actions that make you say, yeah, you know what? My agents represent me, not the people I'm negotiating with as well.
Okay, so, well, wait a second. This is what makes this difficult, and I'm not taking sides here. This is an explanation.
Please take sides.
And here's what I would say. Well, here, I would take a side if I could actually dig a little deeper on this to see what the Writers Guild is complaining about. And, for years, for decades, in fact, the 80s, the 70s, the 90s, for decades, this has been going on, where agencies had different departments. They had a motion picture literary department. Guess who they represented? Screenwriters and directors, of motion pictures. They had a television department, and guess who they represented? Lots of TV writers and directors and producers. And that group of producers was then put into a packaging department. And what that did was that department came and said, okay, well, we have to put this show together and bring it to the different networks.
And we know how the business works.
I'm just kind of explaining it here. We have a producer. We have some writers that we could put into it. Sometimes those writers came from the agency, other times not. But more often than not, they tried to get everybody they could into the show as they were packaging it because it was just easier. And of course,
they made more money.
Well, yeah, absolutely.
Well, it was easier and they made more money.
But at the end of the day, what they were trying to do was get the show picked up, mainly for their writers, mainly for their big showrunners, okay? That's effectively what was going on. It was kind of a service to the showrunners to try and get them up and running at a network. So, of course, all of these agencies, the big joke at CAA and William Morris at the time that I worked there was, having the motion picture literary department was kind of a glamour thing. It didn't make any money. It may have broken even. But at the end of the day, it was television, the TV department, and the packaging department that paid for it all. Because the fees that you could charge
from a hit show were massive.
In fact, the Cosby Show was said to have kept William Morris alive throughout the 90s.
Seinfeld saved Castle Rock, et cetera, et cetera.
Correct. And so,
but wait, we understand this. There's big money to be had. But nowadays, the industry has changed in the last 20 years. And nowadays, there are so many examples of abuse where writers feel like, who do you represent, me or the other side? And they don't feel it's me.
A writer's agent, an actual agent for that writer, might be representing that writer and that writer alone. Meanwhile, their colleague across the hall or down the hall or upstairs or in another building might be packaging
But they have story after story of hearing, no, that network turned you down or they don't want you because they wanted to go somewhere else because they could get a better deal that benefited them more, not the writer. There's countless examples of that if you talk to the Writers Guild and listen to the writers about the real world stories that they're facing. And you can't help thinking there's an inherent conflict of interest when the company that represents you also represents the other side you're negotiating with. Well, that just can't work. That's just not good. And when we get to Bones later in this episode, we'll discover why.
Right. And that was actually, remember, MCA, remember they were both an agency and a production company. And basically,
that's why they had to split up, of course.
Exactly. That's where I was headed with that comment.
We need a guest. We need something. This is going to come out to be a big strike. The writers are not rallying people around them like the lawyers and the managers. They seem to feel like the Writers Guild does not have his act together. That's the consensus from the reports in the trade papers. I wasn't at those meetings, and I don't know what the Writers Guild are saying. I still feel that whatever the money ends up going, them feeling like they're not being well represented by an agency that also represents the other side doesn't seem that heavy of a lift to me. No matter what happens financially, that just doesn't seem really good for you long term. I wouldn't want to be represented by someone whose company is also representing the people I'm negotiating with. That just doesn't seem fair.
Well, that's number one. That was always the issue with managers. And number two, I would say this is an issue for Jonathan Handel to come and visit us and untangle.
All right. Well, maybe next week or the week after we'll have Jonathan Handel on the air. But right now, this week, what are we going to talk about?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we're going to cover the globe from the United Kingdom to China to our own backyard of North America. Starting with the United Kingdom, the BAFTAs are facing a firestorm of protest from cinema owners after its top prize went to the Netflix film Roma. We kind of talked about this last week. Cineworld, unlike Vue, they're not threatening to quit BAFTA. No. They're gone, okay? They basically said, see ya, sayonara. In China, more and more Hollywood flicks are scoring big in the Middle Kingdom, including one film both Michael and I thought wouldn't, the Oscar-winning Green Book. Plus, our old friend Reboots, Remakes, and Sequels is back, though, frankly, if you pay attention to what movies are being made, it really never went away. In Bookfilter news, we are focusing our attention on a lot of industry stories, from the public university system taking a stand for public access to research, to the Booker Prize having a new backer, and Amazon's audiobook business finally learning how to say hola. On Inside Baseball, we look at the blockbuster ruling in a case involving the TV show Bones, as you just mentioned, Michael, and what that case of an independent arbitrator ruled on it, and he ruled that Fox displayed reprehensible behavior, okay? And executives who lied and cheated. And if you think we're just being mean, no. The arbitrator said it, not us. It could have a big impact on sweetheart deals between studios, their own networks, their own cable channels, and of course, their own streamers. There's no bones about it. You see what I did there with the bones?
I did.
Okay. Of course, during a big deal or a big whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office. By the way, I may have had too much coffee.
By the way, if you hear Sperling or I stumble a lot over our words, that means Sperling has not had time to do a full edit and just is like, let's put the show out. I don't have time to do a clean edit. Sometimes we redo stuff. Sometimes he's like, keep going. I've got things to do this week. All right. We're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes. We also pull information from Box Office Profit, Box Office Mojo, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, the LA Times, the New York Times, and of course, you, our listener. And the number one movie around the world is How to Train Your Dragon, the third and final film in the franchise. $82 million on the weekend, $375 million worldwide. So Clearly, this film is going to be a hit and score $500 to $600 million, if not more, just like the first two films. And thank you, China. $33 million in China. So a really strong opening there. At number two around the world is Alita, Battle Angel, the James Cameron-produced sci-fi flick. $47 million on the weekend, $350 million worldwide. So that has doubled its budget, and it wants to claw its way to tripling its budget. If it gets there, they will heave a sigh of relief.
Well, Fox is saying, hey, we're in the black already. We're at break even. Okay, we're in break even.
Please,
and
please.
What you know, all of the experts are saying is, well, you're kind of close. If you can get to 400, you're definitely at break even.
So, well, that goes against our own rule of thumb, which is that you should kind of triple whatever budget we see widely reported. It looks like an expensive film. It's, you know, I think the tale will be if they signal a sequel. If they make a sequel, then I guess they did great. But based on the box office and how far the film fell hard in North America and other places, it's not a movie I would be eager to greenlight a sequel to. At number three is Green Book, the Oscar-winning film. $36 million this weekend. It's, by a lot of metrics, one of the biggest post-Oscar boosts we've seen in a long time. That just happens because a movie is positioned well to do that. It's not a reflection of the other movies. It's just, hey, this movie still had some life in it. It just opened up in China, where it made $17 million. I guess its backer, Alibaba, really turned this into a cause celeb in terms of saying, hey, this is a film we backed, and it's a sort of a China win at the Oscars, and celebrate that. Because it really worked much better than you and I expected.
Well, right. And another way to do that is to basically book it in every single theater that's out there. And so if you want to go to the movies this week, guess what? You're seeing Green Book.
That's still a better, far better, you know. I mean, you can book a movie in every theater in America. I'm not going to go if it doesn't interest me.
Right.
You know, I'll stay online. But it's at $190 million worldwide. Another franchise coming to an end, just like How to Train Your Dragon. Tyler Perry's A Madea Family Funeral. $27 million on its opening weekend, and it's a strong, solid end to what he says is the last film where he's going to play this character. If he did, he has definitely ended on a strong note.
Well, strong note, at least box office-wise, from what a lot of the reviews
It's never been terribly well-reviewed, so that's right, got nothing to do with it. At number five is The Wandering Earth, the Chinese sci-fi flick. Another $15 million on the weekend. That's at $675 million worldwide. I think Wolf Warrior 2 is safe with its title of the highest grossing film in China history at that box office. I don't think this one is going to get there, but it's certainly a massive, massive hit.
Can we actually see this on Netflix now, or is it not?
It hasn't opened up yet as far as I know.
Okay.
I'm kind of bummed because I feel like if there was anything to enjoy about the movie, it was probably the special effects.
Yeah.
You know, so that will be less impressive on TV, no matter how big your screen is.
Yeah, I can tell you that you can see at least around Los Angeles, because of the huge Asian population in Southern California, it's playing in at least three theaters, maybe more.
Oh, cool. Well, it ain't here in Alabama. At number six is The Lego Movie 2. It's the sequel to The Lego Movie, but it's the fourth film in the franchise, and the franchise is looking a little tired. $12 million on the weekend, $150 million worldwide. Happy Death Day 2 is chugging along. That's at $55 million. Cold Pursuit, the Liam Neeson film, that has, you know, been iced by the box office, or whatever awful pun you want to make. It's at $50 million worldwide, doing very poorly, just a disaster on every level for Liam Neeson and the people behind this movie. And number nine is a movie we mentioned before. It's now opening up in a few more territories. It's Fighting With My Family, the sort of wrestling family flick that Dwayne Johnson appears in, and made $7 million over the weekend. It's at $17 million worldwide. But what I didn't notice before is that it's written and directed based on a book. It's written and directed by Stephen Merchant, the longtime collaborator with Ricky Gervais on The Office and Extras and some other shows. Oh. So cool to see Stephen Merchant branching out with that film. It makes me more interested in checking it out. Scrolling down the list, there's just, I think, about two other films that look new. One of them is Resistance, the Yoo Kwon-soon story. That's a Korean drama, I believe, from what I could gather, about a woman who was one of the leaders of a peaceful protest against the Japanese occupation. A very powerful symbolic figure in Korea, and a movie about her opened to $5.2 million on its opening weekend. And another movie that just opened up is Greta. It's a thriller from the UK, I believe, technically, directed by Neil Jordan, starring Isabelle Huppert and Grace Chloe Moretz. $4.9 million on its opening weekend.
You know, I'm looking down the list. Bohemian Rhapsody also had a bit of a bump.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Bohemian Rhapsody, A Star is Born, all the more impressive for that one because it's already out on DVD and available in other ways. So yeah, Bohemian Rhapsody, if you think it's a drama, it's the highest grossing drama of all time, not adjusting for inflation, obviously. A Star is Born, it's already out, available, but people still went to theater to see, you know, 11 extra minutes and see the movie, pulled in a couple million bucks. You know, very impressive totals for them.
However, of all, everybody knows, okay, if you ask the Golden Globes, those two films, Bohemian Rhapsody and A Star is Born, those are comedies.
Exactly. Well, there is humor in it, certainly in the, well, that, no, they, Star is Born was in the musical area. Of
I'm
the com-
kidding.
Musical
I was just,
well, no, but Bohemian Rhapsody clearly is a drama and a musical. But you know, which category you put it in just depends on what day of the week it is. However, we always reach out to our viewers and say, hey, let us know if you know a movie that opened up and has made more money this weekend than the movies we mentioned on our list. At the bottom of the list is Instant Family, the Mark Wahlberg film that made $2.8 million this weekend. I know there's a film in Indonesia that has made more money than that. It's Dilan 1991. This is a sequel to Dilan 1990. It's a teen romance. And there was a report that said on Thursday, that movie in Indonesia grossed $2 million just from the Thursday night, you know, opening. And that beat the record set by Avengers Infinity War. So there's no way on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday it did make at least another $800,000. So we would love to know the total box office for this movie. It slipped through the cracks at ComScore, probably because the people behind it in Indonesia simply don't report their stuff to ComScore. So if you know what this movie made or you know about any other movie that slipped through the cracks, let us know.
Yes, you can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. We're on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox, or you can like us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/showbizsandbox, and you'll see our page there. Of course, all of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com.
Sperling, you are the expert. You actually are sort of a pod person. You represent exhibitors so well. They're sort of ingrained in your DNA, I feel. You see the world and the cinema world from the perspective of exhibitors to a degree. Does that sound fair?
Yeah, the exhibitors and distributors. Yeah, I kind of, you know, straddle the line, so to speak.
Heavens to Betsy. Well, tell us what's going on with Cineworld and BAFTA.
Well, first of all, Cineworld is now one of the largest, if not the largest, well, it's the second largest chain in the world, because if you count AMC with its Wanda, you know, it's one large chain, but not really. Mm-hmm. And in any case, a couple weeks ago, 2 weeks before the Academy Awards, the British Academy of Film and Television Arts, they gave their top award to a little film called Roma, which of course was directed by Alfonso Cuarón and was a Netflix movie and did not appear in theaters. It did not.
Well, no, it played in theaters.
I don't know in the UK. Well, I guess it played maybe in a few theaters in the UK.
Just like in the US, it had a theatrical release. It would have to qualify for the BAFTAs.
Well, and you know what it didn't have? A box office. Absolutely no box office, because of course Netflix doesn't report box office. So when it won Best Picture at the BAFTAs, oh my goodness. Film Twitter blew up. Twitter blew up. Everybody was like, how could you give that film the Best Picture? Especially when all of your other awards went to The Favorite, which was a British film, and View, the cinema chain View, which is an EU chain, said, they wrote an open letter. The head of the company wrote an open letter to BAFTA saying, you know, how could you do this? We might leave because of this. Cineworld said, we're going to do you one better. We're not even going to write a letter. We're just going to leave. We're out. We're not participating in this organization anymore. Which is a bit of an issue, because
that's where they get their funding from.
Right. BAFTA just last year went to all of these chains and all of these studios and said, look, we need to, you know, modernize our facilities. Can you help us raise some money? If not just give us money, can you help us at least go out to the community and raise some money? Cineworld is saying, we're no longer a part of your community.
Right. So they are very upset. Who knows what the blowback will be and whether BAFTA will change its rules or what they're going to do to react to that to try to win back Cineworld and keep View in the family. But the same thing is happening here. Steven Spielberg has called out Netflix and wants rule changes at the Oscars. He's on the board of governors right now, isn't he?
Yes. And he was one of those that went to meet with the board of governors. And there was a lot of lobbying, believe it or not, on Twitter, on Facebook, of people like Ava DuVernay, who were saying, hey, you know what?
People who don't agree with him, yeah.
Correct. Yes, people who do not agree with him and say, listen, this is how I'm making movies these days. You got to get with the program. You know, it's not 1982 anymore.
Well, he's a backer. Well, he's aware of that. He's a backer of Green Card. And during the campaign, he said repeatedly that Roma should be up for Emmys.
Green Book, not Green Card.
I'm sorry, Green Card, the Gerard Depardieu film. Yes, Green Book. Thank you very much for that. So he was a backer of the Oscar-winning film Green Book, starring Mahershala Ali and Viggo Mortensen. And during that campaign, he was one of the people saying repeatedly, hey, you know what? Roma's great. It should be eligible for an Emmy, not an Oscar. He wants the Board of Governors to consider rule changes that would somehow block streamers from competing for Oscars. I guess, you know, if you look at the history, I'm sure major studios would have loved to eliminate indies like Orion and Miramax as competitors. That was until they bought them up. But, you know, for a lot of years, they were losing out to indies, just like the TV networks were losing out to cable channels, all these young upstarts, and said, hey, this is our award show. How come these guys get to win? Well, Netflix pushed back a little bit. They said, hey, you know, we love cinema. Here are some things we also love. Access for people who can't always afford or live in towns without theaters. Letting everyone everywhere enjoy releases at the same time, giving filmmakers more ways to share art, these things are not mutually exclusive. And the fact is, Netflix qualified under the current rules. How would you block them? Well, Spielberg says maybe we can bar films that debut on streaming services, though I think that might disqualify a lot of docs and indie films that also debut on IFC and Sundance day and date when they're in the cinema.
Well, what I would say is, you know, one of the things that qualifies a film like a documentary for being eligible for an Academy Award is if it debuts at a film festival. And a lot of those docs
As did Roma, which they would be happy to play at a festival. They would still qualify. Spielberg says, okay, well, what if we ban films that have quote-unquote limited theatrical runs? I'm not sure how that would be defined. I guess he means if you only appear in theaters for 4 weeks, you can't qualify for an Oscar. What if it just, you know, dies commercially and is out of theaters in 4 weeks? So I'm not sure how you do that or what rules you can come up with that will block them. You know, what do you think?
Yeah, I do think that, you know, I think that if you want the cinematic experience to exist, you have to support it in some way. And the Academy Awards was created as a way of marketing films so that people would go to the theater more often and go to see specific films. So, you know, I know times have changed. I get it. I would have to agree with Spielberg in that if you're creating a film that is purely meant to be seen on streaming services, it really should not be, you know,
but it's not. It's being shown in theaters. You know, Roma was shown in theaters. The Ballad of Buster Scruggs was shown in theaters. Mudbound, 13th, the Beasts of No Nation were all shown in theaters.
Well, here's something else I think. None of these studios wanted to pick up Roma when it cost $15 million. Okay, they could have bought Roma and it would have been theirs. Any one of these six studios, the big studios. $15 million, the movie's theirs. And it probably—
Is that worldwide rights or just North American rights or what?
I think—
Does that include DVD and home, everything?
Yes, because that's what it costs to make the movie.
No, I know, but I'm not sure what their rights they were offering up for that amount of money. So I'm just pointing that out. Maybe it was only North American. I certainly wouldn't do that deal. No. If it was worldwide and DVD and Blu-ray, I would have done that deal.
Now, the movie, theatrically, roughly, is estimated to have made $4 million.
Very rough, but they weren't even playing that game. So they weren't trying to make— Correct. —as much money at the theater as they could have necessarily. So if it had been a Sony Picture Classics release, they might have made $8 million or $10 million or $20 million. Who knows?
The budget for the Academy campaign, okay, cost $50 million by some estimates.
Right, but that doesn't matter. Miramax has done that a million times, of taking a $2, $3 million movie, trumpeted the hell out of it and gotten a lot of Oscar glory because they spent more money on the campaign than they did on the
film. $50 million? I mean,
that's a lot of money. It's a new day, but so what?
Yeah.
You know, and they got pushback for it. Maybe that's why they didn't win the Oscar. But what they pay on the budget for their campaign has nothing to do with what movies should be eligible for the Oscars. I empathize a little bit, but not too much. I mean, if you want to celebrate the best films of the year and you start willy-nilly eliminating the best films of the year because you don't like who's putting them out or the way they're putting them out, you know, what are you going to do? Manchester by the Sea got all sorts of nominations a few years ago. That's from Amazon. But they had a 90-day theatrical window. And you say, well, okay, now we're fine with that. Well, now
Amazon's
saying,
it was longer than 90 days at the end. In the end.
Well, because it made money. Yeah, right. But they said we were going to commit to at least a 90-day window.
And right. I guess, and so, I look at it and I say, well, look, if you're putting $50 million into a – let's just say that's wrong, okay? Let's just say it's wrong by 50%. Let's say you put $25 million into a – just an industry marketing campaign, okay, for Roma or for any film that costs –
It also promotes Netflix. Every penny
there
promotes
you
Netflix.
Go. So you're basically trying to promote another service entirely. And that speaks volumes to me. I mean, if you're trying to promote the movie and or movies that you're releasing, I get it.
Well, HBO is not trying to promote ABC. You know, Showtime is not trying to promote CBS. They are trying to promote Showtime. And if they get Emmys for their shows and the campaign raises the allure of Showtime and makes you say, I want to subscribe to Showtime, they don't mind that that comes at the expense of a network. That's not their job.
No, correct.
So... But, you know, they say, hey, remember the Emmys, right? The big four networks haven't won a drama Emmy in a decade. It's been Game of Thrones, Breaking Bad, shows like that. It has not been, you know, network TV shows. Isn't going to be for the foreseeable future. But the difference here is that in the Emmys, you're talking about four big networks versus 400 other outlets making content that qualifies in most people's mind as television. When it comes to movies, you're not having suddenly 400 competitors for the big studios. And the fact is the big studios, except in a few cases with small indie arms, aren't really playing the Oscar game.
No,
so they're bitching that they're not going to get Oscars, but they're not making Oscar-type movies.
Well, remember, it's not necessarily just the studios. It's also the filmmakers and legacy filmmakers. And I don't mean that in a negative way.
Well,
I mean,
yeah, Martin Scorsese's new movie is coming out via Netflix.
Right. And they're now saying it will have its own window.
It will have a theatrical release. We don't know of what sort net. They have not confirmed, like committed to a 90-day release or something like that, or how wide it's going to be, or will there be box office reported. But, of course, you know, Spielberg is fine, but Scorsese is getting his new movie put out by Netflix. So,
I say, you know what, maybe one way, report box office.
Well, who cares? Who cares what the box office is? That's got nothing to do with it. That's just a fake argument. That's a misleading argument. Nobody, you know, the box office helps you promote a movie and whatever. It didn't stop people from going to see Roma in the theater, and it didn't stop people from voting for it at the Oscars. It won, what, 3 awards?
Yes.
You know, the box office is not important. I love box office. I'm fascinated by it. I know why it's a little frustrating for people, but I think it, if anything, doesn't help Netflix. So I don't care whether or not they're reporting box office. You know, they're losing out on some free PR. Oh, well.
Well, let me ask you this. I admit this may be a horrible analogy, but and we should probably move on after this. But if I produced an opera, okay, at the Metropolitan, you know, the Met, basically, would it be eligible for a Tony Award?
No, it's a different world. They have a set number of theaters that are designated by them that say, hey, if you open your show in this theater, it's eligible for the Tonys for this time period for this year. If you're not in this theater, you're not eligible. Those theaters have to be a certain size, a minimum size and a maximum size. Not a maximum, but a minimum size. Same thing for off-Broadway, official off-Broadway shows. So even if you open a show at Madison Square Garden with a lot more seats than most Broadway houses, doesn't matter. It's not eligible for the Tony Awards. So every award show has different rules. The Grammys, the Emmys, the Oscars, the Tonys, you know, link to that industry. In the film industry, maybe the people in charge of the Oscars will decide, you know what, we're too threatened by the streamers, and so we need to change the rules to block them completely. And, you know, we'll say something like movies have to play in these theater chains for X number of days or it won't qualify. I don't know, but
well, I can guarantee you this, given their recent history, they're going to make something up that's really bad. Everybody will, you know, complain about it, and then they'll change their minds.
That's right. Well, yeah, we've been on this too long, but it is an interesting topic. But it's time for reboots, remakes, and sequels. It's been a while since our old friend was around.
Really has it? Okay, but
no, it hasn't. We just haven't talked about it, but suddenly three or four hit me in the face. One of these is Rambo Last Blood. Sylvester Stallone will be starring. It's about the daughter of a friend who was kidnapped and he has to tangle with Mexican drug cartels. That sounds tiresomely obvious in terms of what you want Rambo to tackle, but hey, don't rule out Rambo.
You know what he's going to say? Hey, I'm a man with a particular set of skills.
Okay.
Because, you know, the daughter is kidnapped. Come on.
All right. Beverly Hills 90210. It already was revived as 90210, but now they're bringing back the original gang, most of them. It's a 6-episode summer event. Much of the original cast was going to take part, though not Shannen Doherty so far, and not Luke Perry, who at the time it was announced, has a role on Riverdale. But then the day this news came out, sadly, he suffered a massive stroke. And this morning, just as we're getting ready for our show, he has died at the age of 52. Luke Perry, I interviewed him once, so very sad news. He also had roles on Oz, the sitcom What I Like About You. And of course, he now is playing the dad of Archie on Riverdale. So another really big success in terms of pop culture. An interesting career. His son is a pro wrestler, of all things. That's fascinating.
What are they going to do for Riverdale? Are they just going to recast the role?
No. I'm sure they'll just say Archie's dad has died.
Okay.
I can't imagine they would recast the role. I don't think that would make any sense. Maybe. I mean, it's a soap, so anything can happen. But I would imagine they'd somehow just say, his dad has died, and let the ramifications of that play out. But yeah, it's very difficult to deal with. We haven't heard anything from them except for sympathy for his family, of course, and sadness about his passing.
Well, and then there's Suicide Squad. You might recall James Gunn. He was kind of fired off of Guardians of the Galaxy, a franchise that he helped create and make successful over at Marvel and Disney.
And now it's a big go, right? He's writing, he's directing, it's happening.
What, you mean Suicide Squad?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, he's basically, DC said, you know what? If they don't want you, we do.
That's right. But the bizarre thing is the sequel is going forward, but because of scheduling conflicts, and I'm putting that in quotes, Will Smith will not be involved.
You know what the scheduling conflict is? Will Smith is still trying to get the blue paint off of his body from starring in Aladdin.
This is bizarre to me. Do you really want to do a sequel without the biggest star of the film not being involved?
Let's see. Let me think about that. No.
I mean, is Suicide Squad bigger than Will Smith? I mean, it's a comic book movie, but it wasn't a huge success. And I think Will Smith probably had a lot to do with the launch of it. I find it bizarre that they could not work that out. Maybe they're just trying to put a good face on not being able to make the deal or whatever. He wasn't interested, had an unhappy experience. I don't know, but it seems weird to me. I certainly would be a little wary of this one.
Well, speaking of being weary, I know a lot of people in China are a little weary that the box office is down 5%. And I know what you're saying. It's only the first 2 months, okay? So box office is down only in the first 2 months. Nobody should panic. You know, I think maybe the reason this is a story is because the first 2 months of the year in China, you have the big Lunar New Year holiday. And so
February was the biggest month of all time in China, which means January really must have been down.
Right, exactly. So you're going downhill, basically. You're going to have to make up a lot of ground in 2019 to get back, into positive territory.
Well, not a lot of ground because January is usually not a big month. It's a quiet month. So therefore, you have to put it in perspective. A down February in North America is not the same as a down June or July. So, the month of the year also matters. So, yes, you had a huge February, obviously a terrible January. The important thing is that there are more screens. Thousands of screens have been added, which means there's less money to go around and more people asking for a cut of it. So that's not a great thing. And, of course, the last downturn, the government reacted by allowing more international, of course, especially U.S. films into the market. Presumably, they will do that again this year. So it's really hard to know what's going to happen on the Chinese calendar because we don't really have a great idea of what movies are set to go out. It's always a little bit murky. So we don't know and can't point to a list and say, look, these big movies are coming out this week and this month. So we can see where the big boost is going to come from, unlike North America, where you can say, hey, we had a slow winter, but we know leading up to the April 26th release of Avengers Endgame, we've got Captain Marvel, Shazam, Dumbo, Pet Sematary, Hellboy, and other movies like that on the docket.
Yeah, I mean, it would be interesting to see if they did away with the blackout periods.
Well, they have already.
No, blackout. Not a quota system, but there are periods during the summer.
They just reclassify films as not being international. So they have gotten rid of the blackout periods too, de facto.
Oh, okay.
They just say, this American film had 10% from, or they sold it outright to them. So it's now a Chinese film. So I think the blackout periods are basically gone as well. It's still up to the whim of the government. So it's not the way you would like it to be. But, those walls have fallen.
Well, that moves us along into our book filter news. And every week, Michael, you bring a book that is ready for its close-up. Maybe a book that's ready to be adapted to a film or a TV series. Look at Archie. Look at Riverdale.
But not this week. But this week I don't have a pick, but I've got a lot of book filter news.
Oh, okay. Well, I know that the Booker Prize is coming up. All of these like annual prizes are coming up, right?
Well, it's not necessarily on the horizon. It's just that the Booker Prize now has a new backer. They lost their corporate sponsor.
Oh, that's right.
Happened
yeah,
before.
That's what it is.
Okay. And now a billionaire has stepped in to save the day. Venture capitalist Sir Michael Moritz is now funding the Booker and the International Booker via one of his charities. It will be funded for the next 5 years. So that's good for him. It's a little sad that, you know, all the things I cherish seem to have to be rescued by billionaires. You know, newspapers, the Booker Prize, anything I like, you got to have rich, wealthy captains of industry go, all right, I'll keep that little thing going for fun on the side.
Steven Spielberg in cinemas.
That's right. So I would only point out, rather churlishly, that Moritz is worth $3.4 billion. So I'm like, why not just give them the funds to run it forever? You know, you set up a trust fund and say, I mean, I don't know how much the Booker costs every year, but it's just a book prize, for God's sake. So you give them, you know, $100 million and the interest allows them to operate every year and it's set forever. But maybe he'll do that after the 5 years are up. On the bright side, he did say, please, just call it the Booker. He didn't say call it the Michael Moritz Booker or the name it after his charity trust. He just said, just call it the Booker like it was originally. So bless him for that.
Was it called something else?
Well, yeah, it was like called the name of the companies that were funding it. The official name was like the blah, 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 you know, the Dunkin' Donuts Booker or whatever the name of the corporate sponsor was.
That's right. I do remember that, actually, now that you mention it. And I always felt like, why does it keep changing its name? Now I know.
And similarly to the Booker, the New York Public Library got a huge donation from another big, you know, financial guy, Wall Street financier Steven Schwarzman. He gave them a $100 million donation, and they've been thanking him ever since. It really actually made big news when they said they were going to slap his name on the main branch library. This is the sixth place in the building where they have honored Steven Schwarzman. I mean, after like four or five, wouldn't you say, yeah, you know, enough is enough. It's okay. I don't need every lobby and bathroom and hallway named after me. It's okay.
Well, maybe he was just trying to, like, he gave some money and went, what? I only get the research room?
Right. I only get the atrium?
Right. And then so he kept, like, giving more money and he kept moving the plaque further and further out toward the street.
They insist it was their decision. And he was like, oh, really? For me? Thank you so much. As one person said, well, when you give $100 million, you get a lot. But it's grown to, I don't understand anybody who wants their name on something while they're alive. I think that's bizarre. I just can't understand that mindset. You're Dave and Geffen. You want them to call it the Dave and Geffen, you know, Symphony Space. Lord, I think that's weird. But
what about Geffen Playhouse?
The
Geffen
same thing. Absolutely. I think that's bizarre. But then I'm not a 100 millionaire, am I?
A 100 millionaire. Well, some people call that a billionaire. But
That would be a 1,000 millionaire.
That's true. I knew you were going to correct me. As soon as I said it, I thought, oh, really?
Is that right? Is there another decimal point there?
I know. Oopsie. He's going to correct me. But can you correct me in Spanish? That's what I want to know.
Sí.
Oh, okay. I guess you can. Because really, what I'm trying to say is that if you are a Spanish speaker in, say, South America, Latin America, maybe Spain, or any of the other countries where Spanish is spoken, you will now be able to listen to, say, Harry Potter books in Spanish because Amazon is launching Audible Latino.
That's right. They have not had an official branch of their Audible audiobook library section, and now they are having an official branch called Audible Latino. They've obviously had books read in Spanish before, but now they are launching it in earnest. They are beginning with a Spanish language reading of all the Harry Potter books. I can't believe that hadn't happened already. And I'm a little, you know, I think, great. It's long overdue. Do they not have French ones? You know, I mean, I would think they would have them for all the major languages. Mandarin, I hear, is very popular. You might want to think of that one next.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess what shocks me is that it hadn't been done already, much like it shocked you.
Well, again, they've had books read in Spanish. They just did not have an official arm, but it's such a big market. I'm surprised.
You know, recently I have been taken to as a matter of fact, I did it this weekend. I went to the library with my daughter to do some homework. Well, she was doing the homework. I was just browsing around. And I was like, oh, these are all good books. I saw them on the shelf. I decided, you know what? I'm going to check them out digitally. Read them on my iPad.
Mm-hmm. And did it work well?
Not really. No, I had to actually put all of those books on hold. So at some point in the near future, what is the name of the – I can't remember the name of the author who wrote Seven Killings, the – He won the, I think it was the Pulitzer Prize or the National Book Award for it. Was it? He's a Jamaican.
Marlon James?
Yes, thank you.
Marlon James. You want to read his new book, Black Leopard?
Red Tiger or whatever. Yeah, Red Lion. Yeah.
Red Wolf.
Red Wolf. Yeah.
Black Leopard, Red Wolf, a new fantasy series by Marlon James, the Booker Prize winning author.
Yes. Oh, thank you. He's gotten a lot of publicity from this book. It's supposed to be fantastic. And so I went to you know, reserve it on both.
I'm sure you had to get online.
Yeah, 200. I'm number 280 on a list that 49 books. That's it.
Well, that's a lot of books. So it'll come to you quicker than you expect. That's what happens. Libraries have to decide how many copies of a book to buy an ebook, knowing that, of course, A, it will probably cost them a lot of money, a lot more than buying an ebook at the store. And they only get to loan it out, say, 50 times before they got to buy it again, or only for a year. It depends publisher to publisher. So there's a lot of push back and forth between publishers and libraries. And that brings us to our next story, which is a little interesting. It's called The Issue of Controlled Digital Lending. Publishers and writers are denouncing it. And controlled digital lending, or CDL, is pretty simple. A library owns a physical copy of a book. They make a digital PDF available on their own. They make the digital PDF. They put in the usual copyright protection so people can't just make multiple copies of it. And then they loan it out to patrons. When a patron borrows that digital PDF, they remove the physical copy from circulation until the digital copy is returned. So they've bought a copy of the book physically. They make a digital PDF available, and if that happens and is loaned out, they remove the physical copy.
So let me get this straight. If I was able to go and reserve the copy and download it, then somebody, some librarian, would have to go to the shelf and pull the book?
Yeah, exactly.
That's
annoying.
They would
make sure that, huh?
That's annoying.
No, that's not annoying at all. That's what they feel they have a fair use right to do. They only have one copy to make available at a time, and therefore that one copy, if it's borrowed, should not be available twice. They can't just make their own willy-nilly audio and digital copies as many as they want. That's the whole point why this, they believe, is fair, because they only have one copy, and they're only loaning out one copy at a time. The only difference is they're making it available as a PDF when they have not paid for that extra copy in that format. Why would they do this? Well, a lot of old titles aren't available as ebooks, so they have no choice. If they want to make it available as a PDF at all, they have to do it themselves, and they are removing that physical copy from the shelf. So if you're in Nashville and you have a bunch of old books that celebrate Nashville history, a lot of those books are not available as ebooks, perhaps never will be. And so if you want to loan it out and someone wants it as a PDF, that's why you do this. However, some libraries are unhappy with how much an ebook costs, and so they are doing that this way to service the people who want an ebook version, but they do not want to pay the $70, $80, $100 for a version of the book on ebook that they can only loan out 50 times before they have to return it. So there's a big pushback, and I would say, you know what, when they're making a book available that's not available as an ebook, I don't see why you have any issue with it. You should leave them alone. If they're just annoyed by the terms for ebooks, well, that's too bad. You don't get to, you know, do a runaround and make your own copy available. You got to either abide by the terms or just not make an ebook available. So, you know, it's a big back and forth, but there's lots of issues between publishers and libraries.
Well, and I would imagine this next story that we have on here, that college students are actually using free textbooks. I just wonder, like, you know, the thing about a textbook is that they can take years to write. They're researched, supposedly researched, by professors and experts, and they take forever to, you know, cost a mint to produce each one. And so that's why they cost $1 trillion when you go to buy them as a student. And now we have, a nonprofit, basically, at Rice University, creating free online peer-reviewed textbooks.
Yeah, that's right. So they're saying, look, there are lots of textbooks that we can generate and people can use if colleges and universities adapt them. So they make the textbooks available, and the student year 2017 to 2018, more than 2 million college students used at least one copy of an OpenStax free textbook. They saved $177 million. Is it any coincidence that higher ed course material sales fell 7% that very same college year, you know, the academic year? If you look at who's actually using this service, the top 10 schools in that list are mostly community colleges, with the exception of the University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana, where I actually lived for 2 years, so happy to see them there. So you can realize there's a lot of room to grow. It makes sense that community colleges, where people are on a tight budget, might be the first to say, hey, do we really need a brand new textbook every 3 years? Do people really need to spend $200-$300 on a biology textbook when the information isn't changing that much? And we have an option available that's free, it's online, and it's peer-reviewed and of good high quality? No. Let's do that. I think this is just going to happen a lot more at colleges and especially the high school and grade school level.
Well, but what about if you have a science journal?
Right. Well, that's very different. But this is really the biggest news of all, I think. The story about controlled digital lending is sort of a tussle back and forth between publishers and libraries. And I don't think it makes any sense for publishers to moan when they're not actually making an ebook copy available or books are out of print or things like that. The college free textbooks, that's a big hit to the bottom line of publishers, and they should be very concerned. This one is a really big hit to those who publish scientific journals. The University of California, the entire system, is refusing to renew its deal with the world's largest publisher of scientific journals. That is Elsevier, if I'm saying that right. They are simply walking away from them entirely. They basically had two key demands. One, they wanted universal open access to UC research. In fact, that's kind of required by state law, and other states are doing that as well. They say, if we pay for research, that should be available to everyone, open access. We paid for it. You shouldn't be able to lock it away because it's been published in a scientific journal. Number two, they are very upset about the insane price increases of for-profit journals. You're sort of, tied. You have no choice. You're a library. You have academics who are studying in a rarefied area. There are scientific journals that cover that area. Nobody else does. And they just say, oh, you want our journals this year? It's $10,000, $20,000, $30,000. They can just raise the price to whatever they want, and you feel like you have no choice. You're handcuffed. You must subscribe to them because otherwise your students and professors are hamstrung. Well, UC finally said, enough is enough. They're just walking away because things should be open source, and the prices of these journals have gotten crazy. It's been an issue for years now, and having one of the biggest, if not the biggest systems in the entire country walk away from them, that is a huge, huge step. Elsevier isn't just losing one of their largest customers. They may also be losing access to tons of potential research articles. And basically, UC is saying, you know what? If it's publicly funded research, it's got to be available to the public free, and enough with your crazily priced journals.
Well, if you this recall, that's what the whole Aaron Swartz issue was about. He was a student. I can't remember where he was a student. But he was basically making these research papers available. He hacked in and, you know, he did all of this stuff that, you know, he wasn't supposed to do to make stuff that effectively the public paid for available. And he was kind of hounded by the FBI and the judicial the Justice Department to a point where he actually wound up killing himself. And he is one of the co-founders of Reddit. There was a documentary made about it as well.
Of course, yes, of course. He was leading the charge in open access, doing some things that were illegal, perhaps at the time. Whether they qualified as fair use, I don't know. I don't believe so at the time. But he was making a public point and didn't deserve the pressure and intense actions against him. And this fight is not over. This is a big, big step.
Speaking of things that are big, what about these next stories? Are they a big deal or a big whoop? Because it's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, hey, you know what? Performing at the Oscars and winning a statue for Best Song sure is sweet. We already mentioned how A Star Is Born got a boost at the box office. Well, so did the soundtrack, which is no surprise since the highlight of the show was the duet of Shallow by Bradley Cooper and Lady Gaga. That sent the album right back to number one on the Billboard 200 charts, but not without a battle from Ariana Grande, who was not amused by the possibility of being dethroned from the album and singles chart. As for the song Shallow, it hopes to top the Hot 100, but we didn't get word yet as of Showtime whether it did. Big deal or big whoop?
Yeah, I'm just looking now. There's still no email from Billboard, and the charts have not been updated. So if Shallow's going to top the singles chart, we will find about it later today. You'll probably hear about it before you listen to the podcast. I think it's a big whoop. You know, it's what you would sort of expect. The film got a ton of attention. It won a cool Oscar, had a great performance. So, of course, the soundtrack would go back up. The fun thing here is the digital battle here. Amazon priced digital copies of A Star Is Born at $4. Then they went down to $3. Ariana Grande followed suit. She priced her album at $4, but she couldn't go down to $3 because there's a rule that you can't be eligible for the Billboard charts unless your album is available for at least $3.50 for the first 4 weeks of release. So her album is just out now, so she can't lower it to $3. She doesn't have the right to. In another 2 weeks, she would be able to. So A Star Is Born sold 76,000 copies. The only confusion here is that some fans promoted this fake thing on Starbucks saying, hey, show yourself listening to Shallow or buying Shallow and you'll get a free drink at Starbucks. And that got caught fire online, but it only happened in the last few hours of when the weekly charts were being compiled. So it wouldn't really have had an impact on the sales chart this week. Maybe it would do it next week. But now everybody's done a pretty good job of letting people know, yeah, no, that's not true. You know, the Google's not going to send you $100 because you forwarded an email, and Starbucks is not going to give you a free coffee. Not going
to
happen.
What about this prince in Nigeria I'm trying to help out?
That one is legitimate. You can go for that.
Okay. Just checking.
I now feel bad because I didn't get to make my Ariana Grande, she should have called herself Vente joke. Something about Starbucks and her. Oh, well.
Scott Rudin was starting to look like the Grinch, and now he's done something about it. The main producer behind the Broadway smash hit To Kill a Mockingbird, Rudin had lawyers sending fierce cease and desist orders to tiny little community theaters around the country, around
boo,
North America.
Boo, mean Scott Rudin.
Yeah, not to mention a touring production in the UK he sent a cease and desist letter to. His message, don't you dare stage the version of To Kill a Mockingbird you just legally and properly licensed. I don't know why he sounds like, Liam Neeson when he's in Taken. Rudin is battling with the people who own the rights to an earlier stage version of Harper Lee's classic, one that has been done all over the country for 60 years now. Rudin says his new deal with the estate supersedes the earlier deal, but the sight of lovable little community theaters cowering from massive lawsuits made it look like a court battle Rudin might actually win, but at what cost to the show's image? Now Rudin has made a very limited offer. Any local community theater company that licensed the earlier version of the play may stage the brand new Broadway production, and they can stage it right now. Even Atticus Finch would smile at that. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop. It's a very limited offer. It's only for the people who've already licensed the stage play, so you can't step up tomorrow and do this. It's a good safe-facing gesture. It doesn't resolve the lawsuit, which is going to happen between them and the company that had licensed the earlier version. We'll have to see if they really did clear the rights and supersede the rights of that other one. That'll happen in court. But at least it was a smart move PR-wise, for sure, because you do not want To Kill a Mockingbird, which is a smash hit on Broadway, to get a bad, you know, reputation in any way, shape, or form.
In the New York Times, there was a whole thing where Rudin did an interview and he said, look, you know, the original play that was licensed by Harper Lee to this, you know, I guess, drama company or to the publisher, the drama publisher, actually stated that if there is a production on Broadway, you can't license it out. So that particular company should not have been licensing it. They did. Because nobody probably checked.
Well, let's not take his word on it, because other people said, well, actually, it says you can't stage it within a certain amount of distance from
Correct.
A large metropolitan city, which a lot of these community theaters would be fine with. The touring production in the UK is one thing. Community theater productions is another. It's complicated. I'm not going to take Rudin's word for it. We'll see what happens in court. The simple fact is that he has the deep pockets that probably the other company can't afford to battle it out, you know? But anyway, Broadway is a huge platform for To Kill a Mockingbird. It's, you know, the show's doing a great, tremendous business, as did Bruce Springsteen. Remember, we did that story saying, hey, Springsteen has opened the door wide. He's not the first person to come to Broadway as a rocker and do a show, but he made it really special. Now everybody's going to want to do it, and people were setting up, CEA was setting up a division just to do this and other things like that. Well, guess what? Morrissey is coming to Broadway. He's coming in May for 7 nights. Going to do 1 week, or it's like 7 performances over 9 days or something like that. But he's going to do a show. It's not a specialized show like Springsteen did. It's just a concert celebrating a new album where he's got covers of 60s and 70s songs. But I think we can see a lot more of this coming up down the road. A theater is empty. A rock star wants to step in for a week or a month. Why not?
And then he's going to just keep extending it over and over.
I'm so miserable. I don't know. No, he's got a tour, so he's not going to be able to just keep extending it. He's just doing it. It's glamorous. It's fun. It's easy. It'll be cool. And there's a big hit in the UK Only Fools and Horses, the musical, a monster smash in London. Just like Everybody Loves Jamie, I still don't know why that show didn't come to America, but I know why Only Fools and Horses won't come. It's because no one here has ever heard of it. It's a hit show from the 80s into the early 90s. They did specials again and again, even up into the early 2000s. It's beloved in the UK, critically acclaimed and commercially successful hit sitcom about two London brothers who are always hoping to get rich quick. They've got various schemes. People love the show. The musical got mixed reviews, but, you know, fans love it. But nobody here knows it. It ain't coming to the U.S.
The show is funny, though.
Is it? Oh, the TV show. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Now, competition in the world of pay TV is heating up. Cable companies have been used to de facto monopolies here in North America in most markets. So the sudden surge of big pocket competitors have left them flat-footed and pay TV customers happily saving money. The latest example, according to anonymous sources and analysis at Bloomberg, the subscribers to over-the-top services are growing by leaps and bounds. Sling TV, of all services, has 2.4 million subscribers. Hulu, with live TV, has 1.7 million subscribers. DirecTV now has 1.5 million, and YouTube has 1 million subscribers. That's a combined 6.6 million subscribers, or about 6% of all households in the United States. They'll need to grow by nearly 50% to hit 10% of all households, but given the rate of growth, that could happen this year or maybe next year. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. It's significant, and I think you framed this perfectly right. It's competition in the world of pay TV. It's not about cord cutting. It's not about some confusing thing. It's customers were paying too much money for TV access. Now they're paying less. That's good for customers, and yes, cable companies are going to take a hit on the bottom line.
Yeah, I mean, basically, it's like, yeah, you know what? I didn't need the 500 channels. I'd like these 50. So maybe I'll just, you know, trim down and...
Well, I like the 500 channels. And you and I have always argued, you know what? People like those channels more than they realize, or when they never watch AMC, but suddenly when Breaking Bad comes on or Mad Men comes on, they go, oh, I want to check that out. And it's easy to do when you got that whole package. I just heard about a cooking show on a channel I've never heard of. Well, I checked it out because there it was. They just were charging too much for the luxury of having those 500 channels.
Yeah, you know, even my daughter on Netflix, of all things, she watched the Marie Kondo... The woman who helps clean up your house.
Oh, right, right. The cleaning up. Yeah, the Japanese, exactly.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's what word of mouth does. My question is,
Declutter.
Yeah, I was like, why did she watch that show and then not go straight to her room and clean it up? Now, the holograms, we've all talked about this in the past. They are coming, just not all of them. A tour built around a hologram of Amy Winehouse has been indefinitely delayed because of unnamed challenges and sensitivities. What those were, no one is saying, but bad taste apparently isn't one of them. The late Frank Zappa reveled in bad taste and pushing boundaries. His hologram is going out on tour soon, surrounded by longtime musicians who played with the artist. Ticketmaster is happy to support the tour, though it objected to the bad taste of a tour poster that played off a song title and showed a penguin in bondage. The people behind the show covered up the penguin's naked butt, and the show goes on. So do tours with Roy Orbison and soon Maria Callas. Big deal or big whoop?
I guess it's a big whoop that the Amy Winehouse hologram tour is delayed. It's bizarre. I just can't. I would want to check it out just out of curiosity as an industry person, but I can't imagine paying for it. Maybe if it got so good and was done really well, there might be one eventually I'd want to see. I guess. Why not? It'd be like seeing a documentary film, I guess. In a weird way, you know, I love Sinatra. If they made it so great, I felt like I was seeing him in the 40s or the 50s. All right, I guess, sure.
Would he be in black and white? Would it be a black and white hologram?
Right, I mean, you could see him in the 40s when he's just creamy voiced voice. You could see him in the 50s when he's at the height of his powers. You could see him in his boozy final day, you know, or you could see him with the Rat Pack. I guess seeing that in person on a hologram, I guess I can understand the appeal, or Elvis in all the stages of his career. It just seems weird to me, but I'm. There's no reason to think it won't be commercially successful at some point. Personally, I'm just not that excited by it.
Well, yeah. I mean, do you see how they do these types of holograms, how they put them together?
Well, it varies. There's different ways of doing it, but I've read some of the examples, yeah.
I mean, the way that this particular company does it, and I think it's called Blazer. I can't remember the exact name of the company that's doing this. They're based here in Los Angeles. They actually hire a body double and spend weeks learning all of the intricacies of the way the person moved. and then they kind of do this motion capture, and that's the way they do it. And then they put that particular hologram in front of a live band and a live orchestra at times.
Right, of course. It's interesting, and that's why some big celebs are getting themselves laser scanned so that they have the option to do stuff like this in the future. They want themselves laser scanned the way they are today. I bet Taylor Swift has done it, or she's going to do it, so that 40 years from now, if she wants to use a hologram of herself at this age and the way she moves and walks and talks, and that'll be her. It won't be some body double trying to replicate it. It'll be her. So, you know, that's why it's happening.
You know, what's interesting is if that's true, if Taylor Swift does that, she might be the first artist to perform with herself, do a duet with herself.
Have no one ever done that before?
I don't know. Maybe not. Live on stage? That would be a big deal.
That would be interesting.
But that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And this week, maybe this doesn't affect our listeners directly, but we're going to talk about Bones, the television show, which was popular all over the world, and one of the most significant legal rulings in Hollywood history, okay?
The cool thing about this is that we often have these cases about screenwriters and plagiarism and studio accounting, and we never get the nitty-gritty, the dirty details, because it gets settled out of court. In this case, it went to an independent arbitrator. He released a 66-page ruling, something like that, and it has all the gruesome details, and your jaw kind of drops as you read some of the things that were done by the studio.
And the only reason that we get any of it is because the victors in this case it was the David Boreanaz, Emily Deschanel, and Barry Josephson, the producer. Okay, mm-hmm. The only reason we're getting this is because Fox lost, okay, and the arbitrator said you have like 30 days to pay. They didn't pay, and so the victors...
They're going to appeal somehow or somewhere. They're going to try and get a ruling saying that it was unfair.
They said, look, this was only confidential until the 30 days was over. If you paid, it would remain confidential, but you didn't pay. So
right.
Now it's not confidential anymore.
Right. So Fox lost a major lawsuit to the stars and creative talent behind that smash hit TV show Bones. It went to independent arbitration, as Fox and their contracts determined that it must. And the arbitrator used scathing language for Fox execs just as they joined the ranks of Disney. Awkward. Calling them out for lying, cheating, and, quote, reprehensible, end quote, studio fraud. So what was the judgment?
So $179 million judgment. It's the second largest judgment in, I guess, Hollywood history, after a jury awarded $311 million over profit sharing on Who Wants to Be a Billionaire.
Millionaire. Sorry about that.
I was
that.
Like,
my
wait
fault.
A second. As I was reading that, I thought, wait
inflation.
A second. Yeah. I was like, but was there inflation literally as I was reading? Okay. So there was an arbitrator whose name was Peter Lichtman, and he said, look, here's what I've decided. The studio lied, the studio cheated, and they committed fraud at the expense of stars David Boreanaz, Emily Deschanel, and executive producer Barry Josephson.
This could have a big impact on self-dealing, which is when a studio sells a show to its own network or syndicates a show to its own cable channel for syndication, or they sell it to a streamer like Hulu in which they own a piece of the pie. All of that could be dealt very serious blows, because those sweetheart deals where they give it to themselves at a lower cost than the market would demand are being called into question, and people saying, hey, that's not fair.
And one of the first instances where this kind of became known not only to the industry but to the public at large was the X-Files case, where David Duchovny went and he said, listen, Fox, you kind of owe me some money on this syndication, royalties. And they said, no, we didn't. Look, we only sold it for $25 million. So no, we don't owe you anything. And they said, he said, wait, who did you sell it to? And they went, look, we sold it right here. It says right here, $25 million to FX. And what does FX stand for? Well, it's Fox without the O.
Right. Though, of course, Hollywood accounting and sweetheart deals have been going on as long as there's been an industry. Jim Garner fought his network over Maverick, and then again over the Rockford Files. There were lawsuits over MASH, and of course the X-Files and Cops and a million other shows. And again, when you open up the books, you find out, yeah, they've been ripping you off.
Well, what's really interesting here is that this ruling, which again, we would not know if they had just paid the money or started to pay the money, It calls out 21st Century Fox president Peter Rice and the CEO of the TV division, Dana Walden, both of whom are now at Disney, and the chairman, Gary Newman. And they say, look, you gave false testimony to conceal all of these kind of like your hijinks here. All of these
and your wrongful acts, and the company Fox has a culture that has an aversion to the truth. And there are huge punitive damages. There's the damages of the lost income and then massive punitive damages. And Lichtman says, you know what? I don't think it's enough. Given the amount of money you made on this show and the amount of money that Fox makes in general, I'm not sure that the punitive damages I have decided upon are going to actually curb your behavior in the future, which is always the big problem you have on Wall Street, where some financial company rips off their customers or other people and they make a profit of, you know, $1 billion and they pay a record fine of $50 million.
Right.
You know, it's like, oh, it's a record fine. But yeah, they should have to pay, give back all the money they ripped off and a record fine.
Yeah.
Oh, well, you know, Bones, to clarify this show, it ran for 11 or 12 seasons.
I think 11 or 12, yeah.
It grossed, according to Fox, it grossed nearly $500 million in its first seven seasons. Barry Josephson, one of the producers on the show, claims James Murdoch once said it might be the most profitable show in Fox history. I assume Murdoch, if he said that, was referring to profitable for the studio itself, as opposed to, say, The Simpsons, which probably made more money, but not all of it flowing right back into Fox. So the show that they most profited from. Yeah, it did air for 12 seasons. It aired 246 episodes. It was never a smash hit. This is one of the big things that they argued about. The highest the show ever ranked was number 29, but that's, keep in mind, that's on the Fox network, right? So it was a big hit for Fox. It just was not a big hit overall. So in season six, when it peaked, it ranked at number 29. And however, it ran for 12 seasons, all these episodes, made them all this money. But guess what? Accounting showed it was a money loser. And so Fox said, when they were arguing with the arbitrator, we want to compare this show to Fringe, which is a Fox show that ran five seasons, dropped substantially every first 4 years that it aired, from $10 million to $6 million to $5 million to $4 million. In contrast, the Bones people wanted to compare it to House. Actually, that's what the arbitrator decided upon. House is a much bigger hit than Bones, which probably falls somewhere in the middle between those two shows. House was a top 25 show. In fact, it hit number 5 with 20 million viewers at its peak. Bones peaked at number 29 and had 11 million viewers. So again, you've got one show that's a top 5 hit, peaking at 20 million viewers, another show that was way down there and fell every year. And in the middle, you've got Bones, a steady performer, enough to run 12 seasons, a hit all over the world. Local copies of it were made in other territories and markets, not to mention all that worldwide syndication. And it peaked at 11 million viewers, but it was very consistent. 8, 9, 10, 11 million viewers for four seasons in a row at the heart of the show.
Remember, they kept saying, this is definitely the last season. And then they were like, how many viewers did it get? No, one more season.
Well, that's what Fox said. This is one of the things he got really angry about. Fox told producers they would cancel the show in the fifth season. This, mind you, is when the show's doing its best ever. They're going to cancel it unless you sign this agreement and agree never to challenge our licensing fees about how much the show would make. That was for the fifth and sixth season. They wanted a deal that would cover the next 2 years. They're like, all right, we've got enough shows for syndication. If you want any more shows, you're going to have to give us this, this, and this. And, of course, they had already committed to renew, but they lied to them and said they would cancel it. They knew the stars of the show wouldn't agree to this release, but they handed over contracts to some of the behind-the-scenes people with lines put in where presumably David Boreanaz and Emily Deschanel were going to sign next, when they knew perfectly well they weren't even going to submit it to them. So they just lied to them in every possible way. And the idea that the fourth through the sixth season, they were the best in the show's history. It hit the top 30. It grew hugely from season three. It was peaking in audience. And the fourth season was the year they hit 100 episodes. So this is a show firing on all cylinders, and they actually pretended that they were going to cancel it. And, of course, they also got showrunner Hart Hansen to sign this deal that they pressured these people into. But what the other people didn't know was that he was already negotiating a much richer, you know, first look deal with the studio. So he was fine. He didn't care about that. He was getting big bucks elsewhere.
But now, but really, the little kind of, I don't want to say hidden, it's not hidden at all, but the little kind of asterisk on this is that the person who came up with the whole plan to kind of make this thing unprofitable, to make
this
show
crazy. This is crazy.
Is a guy named Peter Liguori who outlined the plan to the chairman at the time, Peter Chernin, who is no longer the Fox chairman. He's got a deal there. And this was a way to avoid paying all these licensing fees on a show that cost around $2 million an episode to make. And it would make the show look as if it were losing money on paper.
Right. Let's just say that a lot of studios have done this.
Correct.
So this is not something he invented. It's something, hey, we need to do this for this show too. It's chugging along, but we want to make sure we don't show this show making money, or we're going to have to share out the profits.
Harry Potter over at Warner Brothers with its 9 or 10 or 12 movies, and then, oh, by the way, a spinoff, totally unprofitable. Hasn't made a single dime.
So Luguri, what happened to him?
Well, he left as soon as he said, you know, I have this plan, and here it is. I'm going to go over to Tribune, okay? And then I'm going to leave Tribune. I'm going to part ways with you for about 9 years. But then as this case heats up, okay, you're going to give me a first look deal, kind of a development deal.
Fox suddenly decided, hey, you're the guy we want to be in business with.
Right. And all of a sudden, it's, you know, his testimony, I don't know whether it changed, but it certainly wasn't as forthcoming as it
couldn't would have change been. Because it hadn't happened yet.
Right.
Before he was about to give the testimony, as the lawsuit was heating up, suddenly they sent him to a massive first look deal. And his testimony said, oh, this was no big deal. You're overreacting to this. And as the arbitrator pointed out, it's funny that they would sign him to such a lucrative deal because he only has one credit on IMDb then and now, the 1996 indie film Big Night starring Tony Shalhoub and Stanley Tucci. A great movie, by the way. But nonetheless, Peter is not an active producer. He's not making stuff. And they signed him to a deal that gives him contingent compensation far exceeding top executive producers in Hollywood. They gave him a deal most producers would never see, despite a huge track record of success. Basically, they showered him with money just as he was about to testify in this lawsuit.
Right.
Why and how did this come about? Asked the arbitrator. FX apparently issued no press release reporting its deal with Luguri. They signed him to this massive deal and they didn't even announce it to the world.
Which, by the way, is not
how business is done.
Well, no, it's not uncommon for first look deals, okay, to...
I see it in Deadline and Hollywood Reporter and Variety every single day.
Those are overall deals.
A big, huge...
Overall deals.
Please, don't... You're kidding me. They announce everything in the world.
Well, they try to, yes. I know that there are first look deals, especially when it comes to movies, and I don't even know if the studios are signing those types of deals anymore. But
you'd have to give me an example that was not one that was not announced.
You know, when
you'd have to give me an example of somebody of note. You know, this was the head of Fox Entertainment at the time. He's a big deal. He's not a nobody. They might sign a deal with, you know, some indie filmmaker and not make a big announcement, though I don't know why not, because they love making press releases. But you'd have to give me an example of something comparable before I would agree that this isn't suspicious. The arbitrator thought it was suspicious for sure.
Well, one of the reasons they don't make a big deal of some of them is if they don't...
They showered him with more money than almost any executive producer ever gets. It's a completely shady deal. Do not try and defend it.
I'm not defending the deal. I'm saying I wouldn't point to that as necessarily being the shady part about it. Everything else, totally shady.
Find an example.
Well, how would I know if they never published a press release about it?
Because you'd become aware of it eventually, even if they did not initially announce it with a press release. But again, if you can't name a single example, you're like, but I'm sure it's happened, then I'm not convinced.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, look, I remember when I was working at Saturn Films and at Disney, there would be first look deals that were signed that you never publicized with different writers and producers.
Nobody's
and
that
actors.
People had not heard of? With Tom Cruise? I think former head of a studio, I think you would announce. The former head of Fox Entertainment, I think you would announce. Tom Cruise, you would announce. Nobody anyone's ever heard of where they'd go, who the heck is that? Okay, maybe that one you wouldn't bother with, but frankly, a press release is a press release. But give me an example and then we'll talk. But guess what? That showering that guy with money right before he testifies, which is completely, clearly questionable, isn't even the worst thing they did, according to the arbitrator.
Yeah, no, I think that is pretty bad. What is the worst thing that they did? I mean, basically, Hulu. You're paying them off.
Hulu. The worst thing is Hulu.
Oh,
they signed a deal with Hulu. The Hulu got rights, and the arbitrator sees this as another example of self-dealing where Fox didn't even try to see what a fair market value will be. In his decision, Lichtman then addresses what he considers, quote, perhaps the most shocking piece of evidence related to the Hulu issues. Fox actually signed both sides of this agreement. Mr. Dan Fawcett signed the Fox content license agreement on behalf of both Fox Entertainment Group and Hulu, because Fox owns a piece of Hulu. Fox signed both sides of it. It made a deal with itself, signed it, and said, "All right, we're done."
You know what? I got to tell you something. If I was the Justice Department and I wanted to block Disney and Fox, I would literally just say, excuse me, Mr. Lichtman, can I just borrow this for a moment? I would take that ruling.
Hilarious.
And I would literally just say, this is the reason that these two companies should not merge. Because if you think this is bad, what do you think is going to happen when Disney is 40% of the market?
Yeah, Disney selling shows to itself and renewing shows on its streaming service and syndicating it out and deciding whether they want to make it eligible for an Oscar and what the showrunner is going to want, a piece of the pie. Oof, it's a big complicated world, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, well, I wonder how this will play itself out. I mean, obviously, Fox is now just probably going to pay, right? I mean,
well, they plan to somehow appeal and argue that the arbitrator did not follow the law. It's very hard to overturn an independent arbitration, but they are going to make that effort.
I guess they have to, really, when you think about it, because otherwise
they don't want to pay the $180 million they do.
Well, right, but then it also stands as precedent, and you don't want that.
Well, I don't know if independent arbitration counts as precedent. You know what I mean?
Well,
it's not a ruling by a court.
Now that this is public, you could actually go back and say, look at what happened in this case.
Well, lying and defrauding people has always been illegal. So it's not a precedent in the terms of, oh, this is a new idea. You're not allowed to lie and defraud people. You're not allowed to do self-dealing. It's always been against the law. And I think it really ties into what the Writers Guild is talking about, regardless of what would happen if they succeeded in making agents not take part in, you know, negotiating both sides or representing the producers of a show that the writers are trying to get a deal on. I feel like it's the same thing. It's that self-dealing, sweetheart deals where it's all such a complicated world and everybody wants a piece of every side of every puzzle and it just ends up being bad for the little guy.
Well, some people won't have to deal with this complicated world anymore.
That's right. We talked about Luke Perry, who died at the age of 52. It just happened while we were getting ready to do our show. Very sad news. But other people have died as well, haven't they? Including Katherine Helmond, the star of Soap and Who's the Boss. She died at 89. She was nominated on stage for a Tony Award for some stuff she did on Broadway. She became a star on Soap. That's where I first remember her. And then, of course, Who's the Boss and appeared on a bunch of other shows. She popped into Coach and Everybody Loves Raymond. She was on True Blood and many others. But Soap and Who's the Boss, especially Soap, are her enduring legacies. And it's funny how someone who gets on a couple hit shows, you've seen her for years in your home. And even if you haven't thought about them, it makes a big impact when you hear they've died.
Yeah, you know, I kind of will always remember her for allowing her plastic surgery to be documented.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that.
Yes, in Brazil, the film Brazil.
Oh, Brazil. It's my complications have had complications.
Right. Don't you remember the...
I do, indeed. Yeah. I just quoted it.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, no, that's right. Yeah, no, that was a great role. Absolutely.
Exactly. And surprisingly, just like Luke Perry, Keith Flint, the lead singer of the band Prodigy, died at the age of 49.
That's right. He was the voice on their biggest hits, Firestarter and Breathe. He died from suicide, unfortunately, presumably brought about by mental health issues. And, you know, the UK has this history of people in bands who are just sort of on stage with the group. You know, they're just there hanging out. Madness had it. And he was just a dancer in the group. But there was a rapper. And then ultimately he moved towards the microphone and started singing and became sort of a signal focal point of the band. But those people on stage who just sort of dance and are cool and sort of rouse the crowd, they are it's still got a long history in the UK. No, don't dismiss them as, well, they're not singing or they're not doing whatever. No. They're a focal point of the group. And that guy just happened to be one who graduated to singer.
I wonder if any of those bands are hiring.
Yeah. Well, if only we could dance.
Exactly. Well, of course, this past week, maybe the biggest name to pass away was Andre Previn, the composer and Oscar-winning songwriter.
Right. He died at 89, but it's not a competition. It's not like the Oscars where we applaud more for Andre Previn over Katherine Helmond. But yes, he did win 4 Oscars, 2 for scoring musicals, Gigi and Porgy and Bess, and 2 for best score adaptation for Irma LaDuche and My Fair Lady. Interestingly, neither of those categories exist anymore, in part because so few musicals are made. But later, he became a full-time conductor of the LA Symphony and the LA Philharmonic. Perhaps you saw him perform at some time, Sperling.
If I did, I would not have been born. No, I mean, no, I did not.
No, no, no. He did it for decades, decades and decades, no. Up into the 80s, 90s.
Yeah, no, I did not see him perform.
Oh, what a shame. You know, you talk about Duhamel and others, so I thought maybe you would. He became ensconced at MGM, where he wrote the score for the Gene Kelly Stanley Donen film, It's Always Fair Weather, which some friends of mine think is Stanley Donen's best film. He did the score for Valley of the Dolls, of all things, and he was a big jazz enthusiast. I remember a lot of acclaim for his score for The Subterraneans, which is sort of jazzy, and he recorded a jazz album of songs from My Fair Lady, did jazz versions of all those standards. And, of course, he was also on Broadway. He did the score for the stage show Coco, which starred Katharine Hepburn and won Best Musical. And he was divorced 5 times. He left his wife for Mia Farrow, who left him for Woody Allen, who left her for Sun Yi, who was the child adopted by Mia Farrow and Andre Previn. If that doesn't say Hollywood, what does?
Well, we say Hollywood all the time on this show, which you can listen to every week if you subscribe to us in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. And please do rate and review the show in those podcast aggregators. It helps us out when you do. It helps other people find the show. It really, it would be nice. 5 stars, 2 stars, 1 star, just rate and review it, and we'd appreciate it. You can find those ways to subscribe to us on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find those ways to contact us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox, or like us on Facebook. Facebook.com/showbizsandbox is where our page can be found. Again, all of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, who is mgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's Peter Lichtman for the SupremeCourt.com.
Actually, yeah.
But on the other hand, I should mention, we now know what Riverdale is going to do about Luke Perry's death. They have suspended production while they try to figure out what to do. So the production on that show has just been suspended. That's sort of what happens when, you know, tragedy strikes.
Yes, that's true. I would imagine that if you can't find any of Michael's coverage, however, of such matters at Peter Lichtman for the SupremeCourt.com. Maybe head on over to MichaelGiltz.com for all of his coverage of the entertainment industry. And don't forget to check out BookFilter.com to know what you should be reading. Some of my work can be found on CelluloidJunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.